Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Tony Bruschi, thanks for joining us. We're on to segment number 3 of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Let's head to the courtroom.
The jury is present, sir.
Thank you. You may proceed.
So I'm almost done with the quail pen in the doghouse, but I got to tell you, over lunch, I was thinking about how to demonstrate a little more graphically what you're saying. Your Honor, may I take this weapon out of its box?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Keep it pointed. Do you recognize this? Do you know what this is?
Yes.
What is it?
It's the, I think it's a, you know, like an exemplar 300 blackout rifle.
And this is the weapon, or weapon like this, that the shooter would have had?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm trying to sort of get a visual of. I'm going to come down here so I don't point at you. Or maybe let me come up there and come this way. Okay? Point at you. I'm sorry. So I am not 5'2" or 5'4". I think you should probably be 5'4". But position me. Tempting, but I don't know how I can do this, so I'm not pointing at somebody. I guess what we do is we need to do to come back here. Okay, so position me as that shooter would be. I'm trying to figure out where, how did the hold the gun up here, down here, where?
And then you want to push it down on the hip. Your wrist will have to bend.
This wrist?
Right.
Like this?
Yeah, and you obviously you could crouch in some sort of a shooter stance, but that's
not much lower than this.
That's going to be variable, yes.
Okay, and as I approach the quail pen, the gun has to go up.
Stays the same angle. Right, but for different height people, the gun has to get higher and higher. Right, like that.
And if I go backwards, it's got to get lower and lower.
Right, because if you walked up to the quail pen, the hole's 50 inches above the ground, which is right here.
So I'd have to be like
slightly
that.
Down.
Right. Like this?
For your height, right. About
no, like
a little bit lower. Yeah, about like that.
At the quail pen.
At the quail pen. So you can see, if you back up, you have to get lower and lower and lower. Not like, but the gun has to stay the same angle.
Oh, so it's got to be up, but
up.
I go down.
You go down.
Or get short.
To put the barrel on that green line.
So, if I'm 6'4", and you measured Alex's foot to knee.
Right.
So where would this gun be placed on me if I'm 6'4"?
Well, if you're 6'4", Your hip is going to be about 46 inches. This will be about right here. Okay. It's 46.
Right.
And so you've got your trigger hand
right
about where your hip is. So it would have to be, your trigger hand is going to have to be up where I'm pinching the tape measure.
And this is how far away from the quail pen?
Well, it could be anywhere, but if you raise it some more, a little bit lower, right? So then, if you're at the quail pen, the hole is right here, right? Even if you shoot from the hip.
You have to shoot like that.
Yeah, you'd have to shoot lower.
Now, if I'm back where you say the lines converge, I think it has to be pretty low, right?
Yes, it has to be very. It has to be very low. That's why it's to get a position that would be either shooting or aiming,
right?
Or a basic shooting position. You need to be shorter. If you're bending over in some other body position, that may be, maybe somewhat of an awkward shooting position, then you can be taller, right? You can be taller than 5 feet or 5 feet.
But his, I think you told us his foot to knee was 25 inches.
25 inches.
And would it be, proportionally for me, where would
proportionally for you, your trigger hand is going to have to be about down where your kneecap is.
Right, about here?
About like that, right? And then point upwards 3 degrees. That would be the equivalent of somebody who's 6'4" in the area where the two shot lines cross, shooting into the quail pen. They would be holding the gun like that if they were on their feet.
Okay, thank you. Please take a stand.
Okay, so based on the angles and the basically trigonometry is what you're saying, you say the shooter would have been between 5'2 and 5'4 and back to have the ejected shells in the appropriate place, you've marked that place on this sketch. Where these two folks are—that's sort of the rain.
Yes, and you can see some of the ejected shells, but they're right beside the body,
right,
just off where I've got the yellow sticky.
Okay,
that is the area where you have, I believe, 2, 3, and 4. So, 3 empty 300 blackout cases.
Okay, and that would be consistent with the position of the shooters. In this position, and based on the angle of the bird cage, they would be somewhere between 5'2 and 5'4.
That is correct.
To have a shot from the hip, the lower part of him, almost crouched down hip.
Yes.
Now, let's move on in our presentation. And I'm going to try to expedite this a little bit and skip some slides because you and I were too detailed when we talked about this. And it's the afternoon. So let's go with the Paul Murdaugh first shot. Tell us what this is.
So this was, these first pictures are from the night of the murders. And that's inside. On the south wall of the feed room, there's just a regular window.
And what's that?
Those are pellet holes from the buckshot. There are 9 pellets in buckshot, this particular load of buckshot.
Okay. And what did you do?
So what I did was...
Next picture, please.
When I looked at the... There's the window from the outside of the feed room. When I looked at the crime scene pictures, I noticed that one of the buckshot pellets hit a pine tree and SLED took a picture of that damage to the bark of the pine tree. And so when I was there the tree, there's like a stand of pine trees that have been planted behind the kennels.
Right.
And so what I did, there are 9 pellets, but the pellets had already spread out by the time they went through the window. In fact, there was one pellet still wedged in the windowsill itself.
That you found?
That I found. But there was a tree, and it had some ivy on it, but it had damage. And so what I did was I located that damaged tree and put a mark on it. Just put some yellow tape there. I went back in the feed room. If you look at the pictures of the feed room, there are some bloody footprints from tennis shoes. And it's just as I believe it was Chief Deputy Kinsey talked about, Paul being about midway in the room. That's the approximate location. So I stood there, but I knew Paul got shot in the chest. So I lowered my head about eye to chest level, and I looked through each hole until I saw the tape on the tree, which is where the sap was coming out, where the pellet had hit it. So I determined which hole in the window belonged to that pellet. And then what I did, instead of using a trajectory rod or laser, it was daytime, I did the old school method, which I stretched a neon pink string from the damage of the tree through the hole in the window out the door, because from what I have understood, you know, this shot was taken within 3 feet or so because there was stippling on this wound here. So what I did was I basically took the string out as far as you needed to go, and which is what is in that picture there.
This would be that string?
Yes, that is simply a string. It's pulled tight from the sap coming out of the tree where the buckshot pellet hit it, through the hole in the window, and then back through the feed room to set up a tripod in the door. So that is the shot line or the trajectory of the pellets in the shotgun. And that's where the damage to the tree is. It's leaking sap. And that was the hole in the window that if I stood where Paul was shot in the chest, it was the only hole that lined up with that tree.
Okay, and then what is this?
And that shows basically at the door sill, the threshold of the door to the feed room, the height of the shot, which was at the door sill, it's 3'11".
Okay. Was it on an upward trajectory?
Upward trajectory.
Okay. Next.
And so what I did there is just to demonstrate it, obviously, because there's a string there, can't put the barrel right on the string line like we did in the computer with the green lines. I just held it beside it. I'm 5'10". I have normal shoes on here. That's the stance that I would have to take to shoot up that string. So,
and at what height would that hit Paul in the chest on that trajectory?
That's like about right at my hip or so. Yeah, maybe just a little bit lower than my hip if you looked at the butt of the gun. And I'm 5'10".
You're how tall?
5'10".
So it's somebody not 5'2 to 5'4, but somebody slightly taller.
Right, or moving the gun up and down again. There's a variable here, of course.
Okay.
And then what I did was demonstrate, because there have been some, you know, talk. Well, that's me standing. Again, I'm fairly comparable in height to Paul Murdoch. And what I did was I just let the string touch where the wound is in his chest, the entry wound. And if you look where my feet are, you'll see I'm just beyond the door, which is right where the bloody footprints are. So another way of confirming that this all makes sense here.
And those are the bloody footprints.
Those are the bloody footprints. That's about where I'm standing when this picture of me was taken, with the string going through. You know, we're within, you know, a few inches or so. And then the idea there, that would be, you know, inconsistent with, say, somebody my height. I think there's one more picture here just to drive the point home. Like if I shouldered a shotgun and shot into the feed room, that wouldn't work. The gun needs to be lower. So similar concepts as we said before, but just done a different way.
Okay, next. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, before we get into acoustical testing, let's talk a little bit about the second shot on Paul.
Yes.
And I believe you watched my cross-examination of Deputy Kinsey, correct?
Yes.
And his testimony was?
Objection.
Do you remember what his testimony was?
Yes.
Go ahead.
He analyzed the data and the physical evidence, and he was thinking that the shot was about 135 degrees relative to the ground, and maybe plus or minus 5 degrees, and that he took a height for Paul's shoulder about 4'7". He was going between a couple of data points that he had. And so he had 4'7". And then what you have to consider is that basically that's 90 degrees. And then so 135 is here. It's 90 plus 45. So it's a 45 degree angle into the shoulder. But the consideration was is that they didn't see any stippling on Paul's shoulder. So you have to back the weapon up. And typically, you're looking at 3 feet or less for stippling. He opined that, well, maybe it was 2 feet because it wouldn't work out. And the reason it wouldn't work out, if you back up a normal size shotgun 3 feet to get no stippling, it puts the butt of the gun under the concrete or through the concrete. So, of course, that wouldn't work.
Right. Yeah. So he had to adjust the distance for stippling.
Right. He said, well, maybe, you know, it didn't work out that way. So maybe 2 feet. The correct way to do that, of course, though, would be to test the shotgun and or the ammunition, at least, because we don't have the shotgun, but test the ammunition. Does it cause stippling at 3 feet or 2 feet? That would be the correct way to do that. But if you take 3 feet of stippling, which is what the state medical examiner, Ms. Reimer, testified to, if you take 3 feet in a normal size shotgun, that 135 doesn't work because the butt of the gun will be into the concrete, or, you know, below the ground.
And I think he and I may have demonstrated that with a little red dot.
Yes, you did a hand-drawn exhibit.
Okay. So you would disagree with his assessment that the 45-degree angle shot was possible with a normal-sized shotgun and adopting Dr. Reimer's 3 feet, for there not to be stippling, it'd have to be 3 feet or further. Correct?
Correct. It doesn't work out dimensionally.
Okay. So, now, tell us about acoustical testing and as briefly as possible.
Okay. So, I was asked a question, which is, if a person is in the main house, would they be able to hear gunshots at the kennels? And so the way that you do this is you do acoustical testing, and I could spend a long time talking about this, but you guys probably don't want to hear all of this. But let me just tell you in general how this is done. So what happens is when you have a gunshot is impulsive noise. It's very quick. Gunshot probably only lasts about 10 milliseconds. It's very loud. The threshold of pain is about 140 decibels. Now, when you move 10 decibels, like 140 to 150, it's twice as loud. So you'll see what I recorded these weapons with a special instrument, and you'll see how loud they are. And the idea is that will the sound attenuate, decrease enough when it reaches the house? And there are a lot of considerations. I considered there's a little grove of trees. You don't have a hard reflecting surface. It's pasture and trees and sand. You also have a well-built house. Double pane windows, wood paneling. So it's going to have at least a normal sound attenuation properties. In other words, you know, if you shut all your windows, you shut all your doors, there's a noise outside. Depending on how loud that is, you may not hear it. So what I did was I set up testing. It's the same testing. It's called Military Standard 1474. That the military has concerns about soldiers firing weapons and causing hearing damage. They want to know how often can we send them to the range or what kind of hearing protection, how many rounds can they fire in a day, that sort of thing. So I just set up the testing. And in a nutshell, the blackout rifle, we got an exemplar blackout, same ammunition involved in this case. We got 12-gauge shotgun. We got birdshot. We got buckshot. Basically, the shotgun is around 155 dB.
dB is
decibel.
Okay.
And when we measure sound, it's not on a regular scale. And the reason is because we can hear, the threshold of human hearing is very, very minor. And then we can hear loud noises like a rock concert. So if it was like a speedometer, your speedometer would have to go to like zero to a million. It's not practical, so we make it a log scale. And all you really need to take away from that is if you have something, a sound that's 50 dB, 60 dB is twice as loud. That's how we perceive it, if you have normal hearing. And then the idea is that, like the background in the courtroom here, there's a little bit of noise going on. But when everybody's quiet, it's probably maybe 45 dB in here, right? So if a sound is 55 dB, we're all going to hear it, no problem. If a sound is like 45 dB, we may not hear it at all unless we're really listening for it. Or if it's a really quiet sound like 25 decibels or 30 decibels, we would never hear it. It's just the same thing as you could be at a rock concert and the person beside you is trying to talk to you and you can't hear them, even though they're talking in a normal voice. You just can't hear them because your background is too high. You know, they're talking in a voice like I am without the microphone, it'd be about 70 dB. But your rock concert's 110 dB, right? So all we're doing here is we're comparing sound. I did the testing and also went back and just used the theoretical calculations for the propagation of sound to make sure that my results, which I took on January the 5th of this year, were the same as the results that you would have gotten if you would have done the testing on June the 7th, 2021. You have to take into account humidity, temperature, pressure, the wind direction, those types of things. So I did that.
So what does this slide depict?
So that's an overhead shot of Moselle from the center of the dog kennels, the area where all the evidence is, to the center of the house, the main house at Moselle. It's 1,142 feet, so 1,142 feet.
Okay. As the crow flies.
As the crow flies.
Okay. Next. And this is looking past the doghouse to the kennels?
Yes. So you're looking towards the kennels. The door on the right end of the kennels is the feed room. That's the area where Paul's body was found. And then the doghouse is there. What I'm showing here is that there is a backdrop to this area, which is vegetation and trees. For reasonably close distances, you have to take into account the vegetation and the trees. At longer distances, the sound can carry. Because the sound, when I shoot the gun, the sound is going to expand like you're blowing up a bubble, right? It's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But the bigger that bubble gets, the weaker it gets, just like the sound. And eventually it goes away.
Next. What does this depict?
That's looking back towards the house to show. You can't see the house here, but that's looking straight back towards the house to show that if you were going to do some calculations, you have to take into account there is a barrier of trees in the way.
Okay, next. All right. What is this device?
All right, that is a sound pressure level meter, and it's a type 1, which is a high precision. Normally, when you're recording sound, sound is somewhat continuous, and you can use a high-grade meter. This is a special meter that's designed to capture gunshots because you're talking 20 microseconds, thousandths of a second, the rise of that pressure wave of shooting a gun. So you have both the gases escaping from the gun, and you have the sonic boom of the bullet leaving the gun. So it's complex noise. And you have to have a meter that is fast enough to catch it, and that's what that meter is.
Yes. Next. What is that?
That's a little weather station I had, so I was recording the weather before and after the testing because I knew that I was going to go back and pull the weather history for the night of the murders and just see what kind of correction factors needed to be applied to my testing.
Just curiosity, if the humidity was high that night but low then, how do you adjust that?
Well, there are charts and tables. It's just standard conversion, right? And the humidity was higher in June than it was when I did it in January. The temperature was about the same. Humidity was different.
But you've got tables and charts, calculations, it's physics, or whatever.
For the results of this, all of these modifications or adjustments that you would make really don't make a difference because the results were so far apart. Like what you would have to have to be able to hear a gunshot inside the house. It really didn't matter. You didn't have to make the corrections for temperature and stuff, okay. But I did anyway.
That just shows where you had that instrument set up. Next. Again, picture where the instrument was set up. Next. So why do you have a measuring item there between?
So what you're doing, and so I took a piece of dental floss, tied it to the muzzle, and then anchored it so that I knew that the muzzle was 1 meter, it's a little over a yard, from the microphone. And the reason you do that is that, so you fire this gun, and let's say it's 165 dB. So for every doubling of distance, it's going to lose 6 dB, 6 decibels. So at one meter, it's 165. At 2 meters, it's going to be 159. At 4 meters, it's going to be 153, and so on, because every doubling of distance, that's theoretical. Then you have to add correction factors, but that's basically what
happens. Ensure that your response is, your recording, your calculations are as accurate as possible.
Correct. I'm just following the mil standard here.
Okay. What standard?
It's a United States military standard.
Yeah, you talked about before. Okay, next. That would be the ammunition you used?
These slides are just showing what I used to do the testing. So this is the 300 blackout.
Next. Is that a 300 blackout shell?
Yes.
Bullet? Okay, next. That would be the 300 blackout?
Yes.
Next. That would be the shotgun?
Yes.
12 gauge?
Yes.
Okay, next. That would be the buckshot you used?
Yes.
Next. Okay, and that would be the bird shot, the turkey load bird shot?
Yes.
You used, right?
Yes.
Next. And this is the inside of the house?
That's inside the den of the house, and what I did there was I took background readings in the quiet house. It's really quiet because you're way out in the country there. And there's no traffic. So it was about 35 decibels in the house, which is equivalent to, say, a quiet bedroom.
Yeah, the air conditioning on?
I believe the air was working. The refrigerator was running, but it was very quiet.
Okay.
And then so what I did was I set up some equipment there to measure the background. We also, of course, we turned on the TV, normal volume. So that's up around 68 dB, 70 dB, depending on how you want to listen to. We put a movie in and okay. I just had that. So two background levels in the house. And then the next question is when you fire a gun at the kennels, do you hear it? Do you not hear it? How loud is it?
Okay, next. So what is that?
Well, we shot the blackout out around the doghouse. And then we shot the shotgun into the feed room, out of the feed room, and then with the muzzle outside the feed room. So we shot into the feed room, we shot out of the feed. So we're just trying to figure out, is there anything about the shape of the feed room that really changes the character of the shot? The takeaway is yes, it muffles the sound if you shoot into the feed room. It's not hard to understand. But the blackout was much louder than the shotgun.
And it was shot over by the doghouse where the shell casings were found?
Yes.
Okay. And that is what you shot in the feed room?
Yes, it's a ballistic gel dummy. It gave us something to shoot into.
Okay. Next. I'm not quite sure what that is.
It's just pictures just showing the testing.
Okay.
Same.
Okay, next. And this is the various indoor and outdoor sound levels. And could you, rather than reading all of this, could you sort of give us an overview of, are these the results of those shots you made?
No, this is just actually just from the literature, if there was a discussion about different decibel levels. But, vacuum cleaner, 70 decibels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, quiet conversation, 55. A dishwasher in the next room is 50. From loud noises to soft noises.
Next.
I think that's just a blow up of the last slide.
Okay, so what does all that mean?
Just as a comparison to my numbers, these are other people's test numbers, basically done the same way I did it. And you have a bunch of rifles, and they're between, you have 166 decibels, 163, 161, and therefore. So basically your rifles, all the way down to a 22, which is like 143 decibel. But if you're shooting a rifle with a decent size cartridge, then you're looking at something from 160 to 165 dB.
Okay, next.
This is a similar chart of other people's work doing the same thing, and for shotguns. And basically, your shotguns are going to be 150 to 160 dB, so not as loud as a rifle. A little bit quieter, but obviously 12-gauge still is a loud gun.
Next. Okay, here's your results.
These are my results. So basically, the blackout was right at 165 dB, and the shotgun was at 155 dB. So the results that I got from the testing were in line with testing that
other people have been doing. Okay, next. Okay, so you want us to play this?
Sure.
Go ahead. Wait a second. What is this?
This is an audio file. I could present numbers, graphs. But what I did here, just to get the point across, and here's the bottom line. This will be the 300 blackout fired in the loudest direction, because we tried north, south, east, west. But this is fired in the loudest direction. I'm sitting in the den. The doors and windows are shut. TV's not on, so it's as quiet as it possibly can be. And I'm sitting there listening for the shot. But you can gauge the sound of the shot. And I got a microphone now, but I'm talking on this audio recording the same way I'm talking right now.
Play it, please.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm going to give you a countdown, and then you let Michael shoot, and then go ahead and mute your phone, please. Three, two, one. Shoot. All right. Stand by. So okay, it was about 1 second before I said, all right. So you could barely hear it. We were all listening for it. So if you were in the house, even if you were walking around, you wouldn't hear that. I could barely hear it, and I was listening for it. So what that tells you is that the sound inside the house is right at that background level. It's kind of sitting right in your background of the quiet house. And so if you were doing any kind of activities inside the house, you wouldn't hear it. And certainly if you had the TV on, which will be, remember, 10 dB is twice as loud, so it's 35 if you've got the TV on. There's no way you could hear that shot.
So do you have an engineering professional acoustical opinion, more probably than not, as to whether somebody in that house, without the TV on, not listening for it, would hear that those blackout shots down at the dog pen?
I do.
And what is it?
You would not be able to hear it.
And the shotgun, I assume, is quieter, so it'd be even less of an opportunity to hear that.
Yeah. There were times we fired the shotgun in a quiet house and you couldn't hear it at all.
I've got just a few more questions. Any more slides?
I think there's some more slides, but I think we've covered the acoustics, unless you want to get more.
Well, I can. No, keep going. I don't think we need to do that. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. That's it? Nope. Good. Your Honor, I'd like to offer into evidence a printout of that.
No objection.
Submitted without objection.
This would be exhibit number 140. Big portion of dogs is one moment. Okay, now let's go to one last matter. And you indicated you've done accent reconstruction.
Yes.
And I have a number of questions about,
I guess, all mostly physics. But let me ask you, you've seen this document before.
You recognize that?
Yes.
Okay, don't tell me what it is yet.
Any objection?
This is the yearbook.
Any objection?
Just a question.
This graph you created under your supervision?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's another one, which is 142. So we offer 141 and 142 into evidence. Any objection?
No objections.
They're admitted.
And that's 142. Okay. Hold on to both of those. So 141 is speed from Moselle to Almeda, which I guess maybe we don't have that on the computer, do we? No. Let me put this on the overhead. Let's start with 141. Can I have the Elmo, please? So what is this depict?
This is a graph of the speed of Mr. Murdoch's Suburban, and this is from the trip from Moselle to his parents' house.
And that would be on the night of June 7th?
Yes, and each one of those little vertical lines, the blue lines, represents 3 seconds.
Okay. So two things. Look at 141 and you look at the time. You look at this correlated. At 9:07, has Mr. Murdoch left his home?
Well, actually, the one that you've got up is the return trip, I believe. Yes, that's 141 there.
Right, and at 9:07, has he left Moselle? Have you independently checked the data behind this and determined where he was at 9:07?
Yes.
Where was he?
On the chart, he would be that first rise there.
Yes.
There's a little bit of a dip, but then it rises all the way up. It's a little bit over 60 miles an hour there.
Right.
is right before the dip in the middle. The dip in the middle is when he sent a text message. So just slight slowing. No, back over. Back. Right, that little dip right there.
Right.
So 907 is going to be right before you get to that dip.
Okay. Hold on 1 second. I may have not had it already.
So this graph starts at 907, does it not?
Yes.
Okay. So it means that he is in Moselle at 907?
Yes.
Okay. Questions are confusing. After he leaves there, does he slow down? I mean, after he turns onto the Moselle Highway, does he slow down at all for any point until minutes down the road?
Not until he's down the road. He's building speed. When he passes that, what you just asked, the cell phone location, he's passing through the mid-40s.
Didn't slow down at where Maggie's cell phone is on the side of the road.
Correct.
Was actually accelerating a little bit as he went through there. Just like, I think, 42 to 44 or something.
Yeah,
like
that.
I'm sorry.
Sustained.
Is that about right? Okay. So as he drove past, I think you testified that, where Maggie's cell phone was thrown out on the side of the road, tell us approximately what he was doing. Was he accelerating, decelerating, stopping? What was he doing?
He was speeding up. So he was speeding up from, 42, 43, 44, 45 miles per hour as he goes through that area.
Any indication he stopped or slowed down?
No.
Okay. Now,
so, you study physics, or you actually testify about physics.
If someone were throwing a phone from a moving vehicle, and I believe you went down and looked at the area where Maggie's phone was found, right?
Yes.
Would there be any... describe for me the kinetics of that.
Torsion beyond the scope of his expertise.
Beyond the scope of what?
Couldn't hear your objection.
Objection beyond the scope of his expertise.
Response?
But yes, sir. He is a mechanical engineer. We're talking about a mechanical motion. He's done accident reconstructions where they have to determine the motions of certain objects during that wreck. And perhaps I could even ask him, are you confident you can give us an expert opinion on how a moving object would move if thrown from a moving car?
I'm the judge.
Okay. Now, you've also done, looked at a number of crime scene photos, correct?
Yes.
And you understand where Maggie's body was?
Yes.
And you understand where Paul's body was?
Yes.
Would a vehicle, first of all, tell me the typical headlights, or the headlights on a Suburban, how far out would they go? How far out would you be able to see with them?
Well, it depends on the object that you're looking at. The low beams, modern low beams, which would be on you. You're going to be able to see about 250 feet in front of the vehicle along the ground.
What about the width of the vision?
Yeah, there'll be a spread out to the side as the headlight beam pattern bends around. It maybe 20 feet or so on either side of the vehicle. Depends on whether it's the left or the right, and it depends on the color of the objects on the ground. But yes, the area in front of the Suburban would be well lit.
And I believe you saw the Suburban's placement in the photos after the police officers arrived, correct?
Well, yeah, I have seen the photographs, and I also have seen the path that the Suburban took by the GPS points as it drove up to the kennels.
And based on those, do you have an opinion as to whether or not Alec Murdaugh, if he was driving that vehicle, would have been
Objection.
Able to see?
Beyond the scope of his expertise.
I need to hear the complete question before entertaining an objection.
Based on your knowledge of the function of the headlights on a motor vehicle, do you ever look at that in terms of motor vehicle accidents that you investigate?
I look at it all the time, car pedestrian accidents.
Okay.
It's a well-known area of study in my field.
So would you be able to give an opinion as to what someone would be able to see with their headlights?
Yes.
You do it all the time?
Yes.
So do you have an opinion to a degree of mechanical engineering, more probably than not, whether Alec Murdaugh would have been able to see Paul and Maggie's bodies as he pulled up?
Objection. Calls for speculation beyond the scope and no foundation laid for that line of question.
I sustain the objection.
Okay. You have looked at the photographs of the scene, right?
Yes.
You looked at the GPS data to see where that vehicle pulled initially, right?
Yes.
I'm talking about the Suburban.
Yes.
You routinely take that same data in a mechanical in a motor vehicle accident. You've been qualified to testify about motor vehicle accidents. They agreed to that. Tell me, would someone driving that vehicle been able to see in their headlights the bodies of Paul and Maggie at that GPS location?
And again, I'm going to object, Your Honor. Same thing. Calls for speculation.
I overrule the objection.
Go ahead.
Yes, they would definitely be available to be seen. I can't say what Mr. Murdaugh saw, but you're talking about objects that are maybe 25 feet in front of his Suburban and directly in front of his Suburban with low beam headlights on flat level ground. It would illuminate the whole area under the shed, between the shed and the kennels and the kennels. So his headlights would definitely illuminate that area.
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. In your career in investigating motor vehicle accidents, have you ever had the opportunity to look at how objects behave if they are thrown from or broken off from a motor vehicle that's in a wreck?
Sure. The most common thing is, say, a motorcycle rider who hits a car and flies through the air. So there are ways that you can analyze the trajectory. Say an object flying through the air at a certain speed, what happens when that object hits the ground? The other thing that you see, like objects coming off trucks. Unfortunately, things come off trucks all the time, and they bounce on the highway or fall off, and they go through people's windshields. So it's simple ballistics. It's straightforward kinematics of objects moving through some sort of a trajectory. And then also, what happens once they strike the ground? How do they slow down? Of course, it depends on the surface, but you know, how does an object slow down once it's flying through the air? Like if a rock comes off a dump truck and the dump truck's going 55, when the rock hits the ground, it's going to be going 55, so it's not just going to stop. It's going to continue traveling until it rolls and tumbles and slows down.
Let me get back to a question. That is, an object this size, the size of my cell phone, if it separated from the vehicle, thrown, fell off, or whatever, on a car that's going whatever the speed limit, they're 45 miles an hour, and it heads over to where you saw Maggie's phone found, would it rotate more than 45 degrees in the air?
Objection. Speculation. No foundation laid.
He has studied this. This is what he does.
He studied according to what which seems to be not in dispute by the state, since he is no challenge to his qualifications in any of the areas that you offered him in. The question is whether this calls for speculation.
Are you speculating, or is this based on years of study and physics? I mean, what you do?
No, it would be based on physics.
No speculation there, Your Honor.
You're on right. Permission to approach. Permission to approach. Permission to approach.
Let's all stand for a moment. Yes, you can come forward.
Okay, let me see if I can ask this in a very concise way, and then I promise I will sit there. So, you objects moving vehicle, or even moving vehicle like something this size, if it's going through the air and the car is going 45 miles an hour, will it tumble? Unless it's a spherical object, will it tumble?
Well, it depends on how it's separated, like you said, from the car, or thrown from the car. However it gets away from the car, you need to know that before you know what it's going to do in the air. But the one thing's for sure, it's going to hit the ground at 45 miles per hour, which is 66 feet per second. So as soon as the phone hits the ground, it's going to want to come to a stop, right? So that phone will tumble and slide. If it was just like grass, just like flat grass, it's going to go about 115 to 120 feet. That's how long it's going to take that phone to slow down from 45 miles per hour. In the area where the phone came out, though, there's like some saplings and brush and pine straw. I doubt it went that far, but it would definitely, tumble through the edge of the woods there.
Tilt more than 45 degrees?
Sure.
And when you say tumble, it would tumble, correct? It moved head over heels, perhaps?
Yes, that's what's going to happen it doesn't have to be a phone, but
any object,
a brick or anything like that. It's going to roll and tumble. Maybe if the surface is flat enough, it might even slide.
One last question. One line, I forgot this. You looked at the data on the speed data on the Suburban returning on the night of the 7th from Alameda to Moselle, correct?
Yes.
And the state mentioned that there are a couple of times where at least one time where a speed goes up to 80, comes back down. Tell us what's happening with those peaks, the 70 and the 80.
Well, if you look at Exhibit 142, this graph represents the speed, so the higher the peak, the higher the speed. The sharper the peak is the smaller amount of time that he spent at that speed. So like the one in the middle that goes to 80 miles an hour is just for just a second or so, a couple seconds, because each one of those blue lines represents 3 seconds. So what that shows you is that he does reach high speeds on the return trip, but it's not for a long period of time. And that's why that basically the average speed of Mr. Murdoch coming back to Moselle is about the same as what sled drove it, right? Because you're not really changing the average speed that much because you're driving faster, but just for little periods of time.
Is that consistent with somebody passing a car?
It could be.
But it's just a up and down. It's not like 80 miles an hour all the way back to Moselle.
That's correct. That's correct.
Right now from Moselle. From Alameda, I apologize. Beg the court's indulgence.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll take a break now. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up segment number 3 in our continuing coverage of the trial of Alec Murdaugh, day 19. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.